You are listening to Waiting on Reparations, a production of iHeartRadio.
From Porto Alegre to Belo Horizonte, the people are angry, they're hungry, they're marching to push back on fascism, save their democracy, watching the president talk shit and walk free. He jokes about raping our nieces, thousands of working class people diseased from diseases, forested lands where the trees live decreasing. We gotta defeat him by vote or impeachment. And so they in the streets in the capital, wearing all the masks and waving flags until the bastard goes by the parliament or by the ballot. Doesn't matter, all that matters is banding together so we see the fascists fall.
Hey, what's happening?
What's good, people?
I'm Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca.
And we are waiting on reparations. You know what it is?
Pay me my money.
Hurry the hell up with that. How are you doing?
I am fine. I just got out of City Hall. I feel like we had a good meeting. We declared Columbus Day, Indigenous Peoples Day. So fuck you, Columbus, burning in hell right now. Your day is over, and it is now Indigenous Peoples Day here in Athens, Georgia.
How many cities have made that change?
Probably a lot. It was funny because in our resolution that we passed, it's like, oh, we're going to seek ways to govern with, like, you know, the ancestral knowledge of the Indigenous people whose lands this belong to. I was just straight up with my colleagues. I was like, yeah, if y'all want to do that, maybe we should consider giving the land back.
Yeah.
Like, because think about it, okay, because I've been studying land back a little bit, like, as a movement, and it's public land. It's not like all of the white people, and black people, and Mexican people, like, in their, like, in the homes they owned, in their condos, or whatever, gonna have to, like, give their condo to, like, the Muskogee. Yeah. It's about public land. So I'm like, you know what? Why don't we give them the parks? Give them the parks? Because, like, and got all these old white people here in the commission meeting, like, oh, well, we'll put up signs. I'm recording the podcast. My mom's here. She's looking after the baby. She's making herself a drink. She's leaving now. Should I start over? Or you want to keep that in?
Oh, no, keep going. We're going to keep it.
Okay, I think we should keep it in there. Mom, we're still recording. Oh, I feel like I'm back in high school again. Like, oh, she ruined my prom night. Anyway, intergenerational living. Got to normalize it as millennials and Gen Z become increasingly economically precarious. Living with our parents, can't afford fucking rent. Anyway, so.
Speaking of things that are. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go. What's up?
Now, I was just speaking of things that are, you know, multi-generational or changing amongst the generations. You know, we're of the internet generation. In particular, we're like that millennial age that's like the last of the people who were alive and kicking before the internet took over the world.
Yeah, and
you after
know
it.
Yeah, I don't, like, I wouldn't say I remember life before the internet, like, distinctly. I remember when I first got the internet.
Okay.
But I don't have very distinct memories from before that.
Okay.
I was like 7 or something when I first, like, logged on to AOL or something.
Yeah, okay. So see, I'm older than you. So,
yeah.
So yeah, and I definitely remember. Yeah, because for a long time, I mean, the thing is, it's hard for me to remember what it was now, but, like, I remember that I lived through it. You know what I mean? So it's like, I wasn't old enough that I was driving anywhere personally looking at MapQuest and stuff like that. But I'm young enough to remember when people had to use, like, MapQuest when that was first becoming a thing, before GPS, and even before MapQuest when people had to use, like, regular maps and stuff like that. Like, I remember going on road trips with my parents when they had to use, like, regular maps because you couldn't just look stuff up. And when you had to use a thesaurus and a dictionary,
yeah.
And, like, encyclopedias, like, actual encyclopedias, not the Wikipedia shit.
I'll never forget when I was on tour one time, I shattered my tour manager's phone into a pool of water. Not only did I, like, smash the screen, I smashed it into a pool of water. And mine got lost in an Uber in New York. So, like, we were confronted with, like, how do we figure out how to get home? And, like, how novel it was to look up the directions and write it down on the back of an envelope. And, like, oh, hope we don't miss a turn. And, like, it felt so, like, magical and renegade and just anachronistic.
Well,
stupid.
We only bring it up just because of the revelations about Facebook that have come up, you know, the whole social media thing. That's definitely something that, you know, older generations haven't had to deal with, obviously. But it was reported through a leaker that Facebook had known how harmful Facebook and Instagram were to young users. And not only did they conceal that information, but they actually tried to get rid of that information.
They knew that their algorithm was making teenage girls like suicidal and having eating disorders. Like, they knew this to be true.
I mean,
and they just continued to prioritize profit over the mental health of a whole generation.
In a nutshell, what their own research concluded was that Facebook's business model has to be on polarization and spreading hatred, because the more angry that people are, I guess, I don't know, this is what they figured out. The more angry that people are, then the longer that they spend on Facebook, the more likely they are to click an ad. When they click an ad, Facebook gets money. So they made, at the risk of, I guess this is a public health thing, right? At the risk of public health, they chose the profit margins over the good of the people. And then on top of that, a few days later, you know, the whole shit just gonna, like, crash, like, out the blue, like,
Yeah. I'm sure that was an accident. They're like, do something, quick! Look over here, child!
Yeah, that, I mean,
pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
They could have tried to be a little bit more, I don't know, less obvious with
subtle,
that shit. That's like some movie shit right there. It's like, oh my god, the leaker came out.
Or
what
you know
do we
what?
Do?
It was either a distraction or it was totally like taking my ball and going home. Like, oh really? You guys are gonna call us out for making teen girls suicidal? Well, I guess we'll just take away Facebook then. I guess you just can't have it if you don't appreciate what you have.
Well, earlier we were talking about how much money Mark Zuckerberg lost due
to
the outage.
$7 billion.
Even though the point that you were making is like $7 billion to him ain't nothing, that's true, but I don't think most people are willing to lose $7 billion just to do some nana nana boo boo shit. You know what I mean?
I think
it was much more like, oh my god, the documents have come out. What do we do?
Yeah, the shadowy figures that like control Zuckerberg's limbs via like satellite or whatever and like make his face do human facial expressions sat him down. They're like, look, bruh, gonna have to take this L. We have to continue to extract profit out of the suffering of the children.
Well, I mean, the
but
thing
we can't
is,
let people realize that it's happening. So, just
well,
the
thing
L.
is, Facebook has to be one of the biggest, most powerful companies to ever have existed in the history of humankind.
In the history of
right?
humanity and human
so, yeah.
civilization.
I mean, if companies that are far smaller than Facebook have existed over the years and have, like, just from the sheer greed and from the sheer, like, implicit greed that's there with, like, a corporate structure, you know what I'm saying? They've wreaked havoc on generations of the world. What the fuck do y'all really think the, like, most powerful one out of those in the history of humanity is gonna do? You know what I'm saying? Like this is just this shit because it's been leaked. The book hasn't been written on what the fuck Facebook is doing or what they're gonna be responsible for. So stay tuned on that shit. This is just some surface shit.
Going back to the nanny nanny boo boo hypothesis, however, I can just picture also Mark Zuckerberg like ripping a fat line in his office to look this and like, yeah, shut it all down. What do you mean, sir? Yeah, I said shut it all down. Sir, you'll lose billions of dollars. I don't give a fuck, do it. If they don't appreciate me, they will see. And it's just like line after line. No shirt on. Just
that's the Social Network
version
of Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah. So So I don't know. Nanny nanny boo boo hypothesis is still plausible.
That's the Jesse Eisenberg Zuckerberg.
That Berg
connection.
Wow. Okay. What else is good with you, bro?
Oh, yo, I've got this single that I got coming out soon. I finally made the hometown joint, you know what I'm saying? I got the Savannah joint. So, you know, like the thing is, I'm just now, it's like I've been doing the whole thing independent for a while, but the last few projects that I've done have been with like small indie labels, you know what I'm saying? So, in a way, it's kind of like I'm out of the loop of like consistently releasing my own music on my own. I mean, I'm gonna be working with a label for the album, but like I just wanted to put out just some random songs leading up to it. So right now I'm in the process of like, you know, it's almost like I'm starting from scratch, like I'm a new artist. It's like, oh man, all right, I gotta get in on this TikTok thing. All right, let me start making TikTok videos and shit. And, oh man, I guess I have to start paying more attention to my Instagram shit. So I'm going through a lot of that motions, and a lot of that is, you know, like a learning experience in a way for me. So it's like,
yeah,
it's added a layer of, I guess, invigoration. Because, you know, I don't like doing shit unless I can get good at it. So it's one of those things.
I'm the same. Oh my God, we're the same. I don't like, I don't like playing board games with people.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Only Scrabble, because I can dominate everyone.
Because I know how to play, exactly.
I can kick everyone's ass. Chess, I have to learn the rules of the new game and you're going to beat me in the first 5 times? Fuck that.
Exactly.
No, I'm exactly the same.
Like, that's how I got out of gaming and stuff. Whenever, like, any of my friends like, yo, let's play Call of Duty. I'm like, bet. Let's get it. I'm, like, pulling out the version from, like, 2008. They're looking at me like, yo, what you doing? I was like, nah, man.
What you doing, son?
I can't do it. Anyway, yeah, so I'm doing that whole thing with the song and stuff. And, you know, we're going to be hearing more about that in November, because that's when it's coming out. I don't want to bother teasing it now, but to let people know that there is new music coming out. And
dope.
Yeah. So what do we got going on today on the show?
So today on the show, we're going to go on to part two, a continuation of our topic from last week, discussing the rise of fascism and the potential for a coup in Brazil with a writer, researcher, author of the new book, The End of the End of History, Alex Hokuli, who's based in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and has written on the topic of, you know, Brazilian fascism and, you know, its threats to democracy for Jacobin and other outlets. So after the jump, we'll be getting into it with Alex. And then afterwards, we'll be coming back to talk a little bit about other manifestations of political unrest in hip hop, with a couple of artists that are real dope. So stay tuned for that. You ready? Let's get it. You wanna go? Let's go. So today I'm excited to be joined by Alex Hokuli, writer and researcher based in Sao Paulo, host of the BungaCast podcast, and author of the recent book, The End of the End of History, here to talk to us a little bit about the anti-Bolsonaro protests that took place over the weekend, as well as just the general context in which they've taken place. So, Alex, how are you today?
I'm reasonably well, thank you. Yeah, it's a bit chilly here in Sao Paulo. We're not fully out of winter yet, but we're getting there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Does it rain a lot in Sao Paulo? It rained a ton when I lived in Porto Alegre, just like all the time. It's super gloomy.
It depends what your standards are. I used to live in London, so by contrast, Sao Paulo doesn't rain very much, no.
Word. Well, let's get into it. Let's start off. I'd love to hear about how it went over the weekend. We talked a little bit last week in the lead up to this episode that there would be some anti-Bolsonaro protests across Brazil in response to the pro-Bolsonaro protests that took place in September. So what was the turnout and what was the coalition like in the streets?
Well, I mean, I was here in Sao Paulo. I still am. And I'd gone along to the protests on Sunday. And these were set up to be the first big anti-Bolsonaro protests on the left, and that's an important qualification, on the left for quite a while, for quite a couple of months, since around June or something was the last one. The turnout was decent, but at the same time, the protests lacked a bit of energy and was strangely fragmented based around different activist groups on the streets, different, you know, parties, or for example, the student unions or different trade unions. And so as a consequence, it maybe wasn't a kind of massive show of force on the part of the left in the way that might have been expected. I think an important kind of backdrop to this, and I guess the baseline against which we compare these left-wing protests, have been recent protests by the right. So on September the 7th, and I guess we'll come on to talk a little bit more about that, but there were pro-Bolsonaro protests, which was the biggest organized demonstration by pro-Bolsonaro forces since he was elected in 2018. And that one mobilized 100,000 plus people in São Paulo and in Brasilia, the federal capital, but not in other state capitals. And so that was a big turnout, but obviously there was a huge amount invested into that, both kind of morally as well as financially. And so that was seen to be a bit of a flop. Then a couple of weeks ago, you had right-wing anti-Bolsonaro demonstrations. If you can,
yeah. Tell me about that.
So they are led by groups like the Free Brazil Movement, for example, or Come to the Streets, which were groups that were formed around 2015 to fight for the impeachment of the Workers' Party president at the time, Dilma Rousseff. Something they ultimately succeeded in pushing, albeit, you know, with a lot of parliamentary maneuvering that went on behind that to lead to the parliamentary coup of 2016. These groups then, I mean, if you were to ask them and if they had to respond honestly, I'm pretty sure all of them would have voted for Bolsonaro in 2018. But they see themselves as more liberal. I mean, liberal not in the American sense, meaning left-wing, but liberal in the sense of economically liberal, right? So they're kind of neoliberal groups who don't identify with the sort of more kind of culture war orientation of Bolsonaro and maybe reject some of the more obvious or naked authoritarianism. But, you know, ultimately these are Bolsonaristas with buyer's remorse, if you want to put it that way. And they manage very small numbers. They manage very small numbers. And I think that proves that that sort of politics just has no base in Brazil today. And so all the right wing who had previously been anti-Dilma, who had been anti-Workers' Party, voted for Bolsonaro. And now the electorate is pretty polarized between Bolsonaro and looking and the left then probably looking to vote Lula in 2022. So in that context, you know, how did the left-wing protest do? It was okay, but it wasn't, it was still mainly the sort of activist bases of different groups, of different parties, without real sort of mass support.
And so I think in some of the coverage I was reading, there were some folks interviewed who were around for April 10, 1984, and like sort of hoping that this moment could be similar to that one in Brazil, and that it was like a watershed moment for the end of the military dictatorship. And so I was wondering what you might think the potential impacts would be of this protest, though it did not have perhaps the numbers, the show of force that folks were hoping that it would.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange to kind of read the political temperature. I think there's an element of, you know, we're a year away from the election. There's an element maybe just of, let's just wait until the election. Bolsonaro looks pretty likely to lose. You know, he's polling at around 25%. In the first round, Brazil has two rounds of presidential election. So the first two front runners go to a second round if neither achieves over 50%. And so Bolsonaro in the first round is polling at 25%. And then the second round, only around 30%, i.e. showing he has a very hardcore base, which is not abandoning him and won't abandon him. But he's not able to reach very far beyond that. I suspect when an election comes, he'll be able to reach a little bit further, especially as it'll be against Lula, former president of the Workers' Party, who is, who's still hated by, a section of a fairly substantial section of the population still. So I think the reality is that the protests won't have kind of transformed anything, and there's a sense of, well, still a sense of exhaustion. You know, Brazil has, and this is an important context, had on the first kind of political level had waves of mobilization since 2013, which have been very important. And there are sequences of protests, one after the other, both on the left and then especially on the right. And there's maybe an element of just exhaustion, that there was a very intense period of 5 years of street mobilizations, which has now been exhausted. Then you have the pandemic. Then you have a severe economic crisis, which still continues. Brazil hasn't really recovered from the crisis of 2014-15. And then on top of that, you have the fact that prices are rising pretty severely. So there's a lot of inflation, fuel and food price inflation, which is biting really hard. You know, like having a barbecue and having beef is a pretty big part of Brazilian culture.
And
you lived in the South, so there it's really big. But it's big across the country. And, you know, Brazilians aren't able to eat beef now people have had to really cut their consumption of beef because prices have risen so much. But also chicken, pork, rice, beans, everything, all the staples. And so at the moment, there's just a sense of like maybe kind of hunkering down. If you want to talk about kind of what could change, if I want to, you know, make some prognoses, I think one thing to keep an eye on in terms of whether people will be driven to the streets, whether there'll be some, you know, real anger against Bolsonaro rather than just a sense of slumping towards the next election. There's the fact that Brazil is facing possible blackouts, like rolling blackouts, because mm-hmm. there has been a lot of drought, which means that the hydropower plants don't have enough water. Mm-hmm. And so they're having to depend on sort of other energy sources. And there looks like there'll have to be some sort of rationing and blackouts. If that happens, that might be a bit of a trigger. And who knows where that might lead. But I think it's worth, you know, kind of, we tried to look across the rest of the continent. And if you can see the sort of mass demonstrations and uprisings you've had in Colombia, in Ecuador, and in Chile over the past 2 years, and all of those to different degrees driven by, you know, sudden increases in prices or in taxes and things like that, it's not impossible that something similar happens in Brazil.
Oh, sorry, it snagged for a second, so I was just pausing to let it catch up. In your piece in Jacobin, you said that a coup is perhaps more likely than we feared in the States in the lead-up to last year's presidential election, but still unlikely, and I wondered if you could break down for us a little bit of why you think that is.
Yeah, so I mean, I would kind of discourage any comparisons with the U.S. I think, just to make this clear, or at least to make my perspective clear, I don't think there was any risk whatsoever of a coup in the U.S. January 6th was completely overblown. It was just a couple of malcontents being angry, and police forces let them into the Capitol, and nothing really happened. There was no risk of the military or sections of the establishment breaking with democratic norms and backing Trump to remain in power. I don't think that was the case at all. In Brazil, the situation is obviously far more precarious. One, because democracy, such as it is much less consolidated. The elite are less wedded to kind of the institutionality, the kind of general kind of norms and things like that. Democracy has been seriously weakened since the 2016 parliamentary coup or institutional coup against Dilma Rousseff of the Workers' Party. Bolsonaro, to a certain extent, represented the consummation of that coup because you had kind of new clean elections, which sort of wiped the slate clean and made everybody forget somehow that this institutional rupture had happened. Bolsonaro, while in power, has consistently threatened institutions, and not necessarily democratic institutions. I mean, most of his recent fire has been turned against the Supreme Court, which is, you know, it's a counter-majoritarian institution, right? It's not a representative of the people who the people elect. Mm-hmm. But it kind of has this weird sort of shadow theater element to it, where Bolsonaro is fighting with other powers. He's there, sat in the presidential palace, you know, firing barbs at the Supreme Court. And that's all off in Brasilia. It kind of doesn't involve the mass of people, right? So it's kind of has this weird sort of spectral quality to it. Nevertheless, the threats are, you know, concerning. He's aware that he doesn't have mass support. And so it's not like you'd have a repeat of sort of the 1964 military coup in Brazil, which lasted 21 years. And had the support of the military, the whole of the bourgeoisie, large parts of the, kind of the middle class, and the United States. You know, that whole configuration, which is a kind of classic Cold War sort of coup, wouldn't happen today. So despite some sort of left-wing fears of suddenly there being tanks on the streets, I don't see that happening. Or at least if there were to be some coup or some more obvious rupture with democracy, it would happen in a different way. And it, and if you look around the world, you know, these things nowadays are happen in much more kind of gradual ways. So, I mean, if you just want to take the example of like Turkey or of Hungary, all of which are sliding towards authoritarianism, it's all done by elected presidents who kind of wear away at democratic checks and balances. And that would be possible in Brazil, would Bolsonaro be reelected, but that at the moment isn't looking plausible. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the worry in the lead up to the September the 7th protests, which were the big pro-Bolsonaro protests, was that they would try to invade the Supreme Court building, even try to launch a coup. And then there's questions over like who the major institutional forces and actors are there who would back that, right? So you have to, it's, you know, the president just can't decide to do a coup, right? You know, you need troops or something, right? And his administration is packed to the rafters with military officers, both mm-hmm. at the level of his cabinet with like top generals, but also throughout the kind of top levels of the federal administration, he's packed it with military men. So they are kind of guaranteeing his presidency. But on the other hand, it's not entirely clear whether they want to break with democracy and whether they would want to rule directly, whether they want the responsibility for that. They've already overseen this Bolsonaro period, which has been a disaster economically, in health terms. You know, Bolsonaro has obviously like denied the pandemic and not lifted a finger to do anything, declined to buy vaccines when he could have bought vaccines. People in administration try to buy vaccines, but with some like little graft scheme where they get paid extra to buy vaccines and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it's obviously been a complete social and political disaster. And I don't know if the military, you know, want more of that, basically. So that's not entirely clear. They might be more interested in maintaining their own privileges and being seen as defenders of the Constitution than in actually taking power and ruling directly. So that's not entirely clear. The other element is Brazil's massive military police forces. Now, these are police forces. They're like mm-hmm. beat cops, but they're also riot cops and responsible for a huge number of murders every year. They're organized at a state level, but, and so they're commanded by the state governors, but they in total number larger than the army, and it's actually the largest armed body of men in Latin America. And they are very, very pro-Bolsonaro, and that's concerning. There was a lot of talk before September the 7th that these police officers would maybe mutiny or at the very least show up at the demonstrations, either in uniform or in plain clothes. Something that's illegal, by the way. You're not allowed as a police officer to kind of manifest yourself politically. That didn't seem to happen. So, you know, that's good at least. So, you know, if you're asking me to kind of draw, to sort of sum up and ask, say what, how likely a coup actually would be, I think the scenario would demand some sort of wider instability or outbreak of mass disorder of some sort. For then the military to feel they have to intervene to kind of give a just cause for a coup. I don't think there would be a coup kind of, you know, like lightning on a clear day sort of thing.
Yeah. And even given some of the economic precarity that the Brazilian working class is facing, given the pandemic and, the fallout for the economy, that sort of social upheaval doesn't seem likely.
No, exactly. I mean, of course, if there were some sort of, just for the sake of argument, if there were mass protests and riots with rolling blackouts, I mean, this is completely purely speculative. I don't like to kind of go into kind of fear mongering or whatever. But yeah. But if in that scenario, then yes, the military might feel they need to put troops on the streets, which is something that they did in Rio relatively recently, where they took over policing in response to the kind of insecurity situation there. But, you know, it was fairly badly handled. responsible for a lot of killings. The security situation didn't improve, so it ended up being a little bit for show. So it's not an, again, I think the likelihood would be more that the military would enter into like a sort of peacekeeping capacity. And I say that kind of ironically, because Brazil did send peacekeeping troops to Haiti and had a big presence there and were responsible for loads of human rights abuses and things like that. So when I say peacekeeping, I don't mean to say that that's like a good thing. But yeah, so I guess, you know, summing up, I think there would need to be some sort of... they would need to see some sort of just cause of some sort of mass unrest for them to then intervene.
Well, that's good news. I mean, in the sense that it seems like, despite some of the fears that have been stoked recently, especially I think in the international media that's been picked up a lot regarding the potential for a coup, seems like, you know, the election's coming up next year. Hopefully there'll be a peaceful transfer of power. And if we could, you know...
I'm not sure there'll be a peaceful transfer of power. Yeah, so this is the thing. I'm not sure there'll be a peaceful transfer of power. I mean, I think Bolsonaro will kick up a fuss in some sense, yeah, and has already been sowing the seeds for a long time, arguing that the voting system, which is in Brazil fully electronic, we're far more advanced than the United States here. no hanging chads or anything like that. Yeah. And it's been something which has never had any credible allegations of fraud against it. The system's pretty secure, it works, etc. It delivers results pretty immediately, and that's that. But Bolsonaro has been, for a long time, trying to undermine faith in it. And of course, it has no basis in reality, but that, of course, that's not the point. The point is to demoralize the election, demoralize people's faith in democracy. And so he already has alleged that the 2018 election, which he won, was fraudulent, which of course is kind of questionable. But again, this is kind of following Trump's tactics, and yeah, often quite explicitly, self-consciously. And he's going to do the same in 2022. And there's going to be a lot of kind of, you know, propaganda from him, you know, what is now called fake news, but I prefer to just be more traditional and call it propaganda. And so I think, you know, whether he leaves office peacefully or not, I mean, it depends what you define as peacefully. I think there will be some sort of resistance on his part, some lawsuits, maybe there'll be protests, because of course his hardcore base is relatively strong. It's not a huge part of the population, but it's maybe a nucleus of like 20% or something. And, you know, that's still substantial enough that it can cause, you know, serious disruption. And so I think, at least in terms of the most the sectors which are most ideologically wed to him, I mean, the real hardcore kind of nutty culture warrior types who follow him, yeah, and hardcore authoritarians, they might not accept the election result, and I don't know what goes from there, you know, what the next step there would be, whether there would be some kind of here sort of making a U.S. comparison, despite what I said earlier, like a kind of January 6th sort of moment, yeah, but perhaps a bit more destabilizing. I think the question you always have to ask, you know, is not like, oh, are there lots of people who are angry and are going to cause a mess, but, you know, what are the institutional forces? What are the balance of forces kind of across society? And I think a lot of institutional actors, you know, if Bolsonaro were to lose the election pretty clearly and the winner was to be Lula, who would then have stitched up a lot of deals with a lot of the old elite, with a lot of the military establishment, with a lot of congressmen who traced their own histories back to the dictatorship when they were kind of the civil participants in the dictatorship, right? So a lot of bad guys, Lula will have stitched up a lot of deals with them. And he is currently doing that, right? So it's important also to note as an aside that any Lula government will not be a radical government. It won't even be as moderate center-left as it was the first time round from 2002 until 2010. It will be a government which is completely compromised with the old establishment. So will it be better than Bolsonaro? For sure. But there should be no real left-wing enthusiasm for the return of Lula. Maybe only relief that Bolsonaro is gone. So I think if Lula's able to manage that and able to do deals, and if Lula does one thing, it's does deals. I mean, that is his thing. He's a great conciliator. Ever since his more radical trade union days in the 70s, he was a guy who always made deals, right? Who always found a middle path, is good with people, and so on. So if he's able to do that, then why would a lot of the elites decide to, you know, support Bolsonaro's claims that he was frauded out of an election? The instability ensuing from that is probably not worth their while, because ultimately they're far more narrowly self-interested in, for example, making their sectional interests known and defended. So, you know, if finance is happy with Lula, if Lula is not going to curtail agribusiness too much, which is, you know, one of Bolsonaro's main backers, then I think they'll go along with that. You know, it's important to note that among Bolsonaro's, like, capitalist support, the hardest core of that is agribusiness, and as well as some kind of sections of kind of big retail and things like that. He's kind of lost a lot of the sort of financial classes support, because Bolsonaro hasn't been a total hardcore neoliberal in terms of prioritizing various kind of reforms, right? Kind of tax reform, pension reform, and things like that. And as a consequence, they don't see him necessarily as their guy. Agribusiness still sees Bolsonaro as their guy, but they're not ideologically wedded to him en masse. You know, it's still kind of a sectional interest. It's just, you know, narrowly self-interested in economic terms. So, I'm not sure that they would necessarily force a rupture with democracy for all the problems that would cause. If I can highlight, like, another thing of kind of what might still happen, because there's been a lot of talk about impeachment of Bolsonaro. There's been over 100 impeachment requests filed against him. And because of the configuration of Congress and Bolsonaro's appointees and everything, that won't advance, because he's basically bought off Congress with enough pork barrel spending that they won't seek to impeach him. But if he's losing support and there's a door now opening to impeach him, then the conditions might be changing and make it more likely. The reason they might want to impeach Bolsonaro is that they know that the election is polarized between Bolsonaro and Lula, neither of whom they want. And so if there's a possibility of a potential third way candidate, and of course, all the major newspapers have been talking up various different third way candidates. And it's the usual thing, you know, they kind of float a balloon and they go, hey, this guy's young and innovative and modern, and we're going to bring him
give
in.
Give us a try.
Exactly. And what happens is that, like, you know, he flatlines in the polls and nothing happens and no one talks about him again, after a month. And that's happening now, and, like, it'll continue happening. But the reality is that none of them are polling over, like, in double digits. And that's not going to change. And the parties are also themselves, like, all now kind of, because Brazil has a hugely fragmented party system, has, like, 27 different parties. And so a lot of them are now joining up together because of some electoral reform allowing them to kind of combine into sort of new party unions, and that they're now concerned with that, which also shows that they're not interested necessarily in fielding a third party candidate, because a third way candidate, so to speak, because they're mainly looking at kind of guaranteeing enough TV airtime and getting Congress people reelected and so on. So
I see.
So because of that inability to really get any wind behind a third way candidate, the only way they could maybe manage that would be to take Bolsonaro out of the game and therefore open up the field on the right for a kind of more traditional right-wing figure who isn't Bolsonaro. And so that might yet happen, whether it's an impeachment or the canceling of his 2018 electoral slate, which has never ever happened before. But because they have all these allegations of improper use of fake news during the election, especially via WhatsApp and lots of kind of illegal funding, which is something that obviously fell foul of electoral rules back in 2018, and everybody knew about it, but they were never going to act on it. You know, the Supreme Court was never going to act on it. But they've had this in their back pocket, and so they might still yet act on it, and that would mean not just Bolsonaro being impeached, but it actually would mean that the slate would be canceled. The vice president would also lose his position, and Brazil.
So everybody running with them would be out.
It would be out, exactly.
Yeah.
So that whole presidential slate would be out. And then until the election, so let's say, you know, whatever it would be, 10 months or you know, until that would, until the election, Brazil would then elect a president indirectly in Congress, right? So kind of parliamentary system. And that's the big concern, that that if that were short term, then it wouldn't matter so much. And there'd be new elections as planned in October 2022. But Brazil's Congress has always been trying to maneuver towards a parliamentary system, which would be really anti-democratic because Congress is already kind of a mess, stock filled with, you know, kind of a bunch of reactionaries. And, you know, the parliament, the congressional elections are much more sort of clientelistic than the presidential elections, which are kind of the most democratic part of Brazil's system. And if you... and if you switch to parliamentary system, that basically means that that a bunch of congressmen who have no popularity whatsoever can then indirectly choose a president. And so they're always trying to maneuver towards that. And that's quite concerning. So, you know, when I say that there's no coup attempt or that the risks of a coup are probably not that great, that isn't to say that Brazilian democracy is in a healthy state at all.
I see. I appreciate you breaking it all down. And I wanted to see if you want to let people know where they could follow you, get your new book, or anything like that.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I am active on Alfe Bunga Bunga, which is at BungaCast on all social media, or BungaCast.com. That's my global politics podcast with which I co-host with two other guys, George and Phil. We now have a big series coming out on generational politics, which maybe your listeners would be interested in checking out. And my book, The End of the End of History, is on sale now, kind of covering this strange moment that we're living in of an increasingly turbulent political world.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being here with us.
Cheers.
Oh, let me get it. I got it. Okay, so this cat's name, Emcida, real name, Leandro Roque de Oliveira. He's been making music for more than a decade, born and based in Sao Paulo. He's recorded 3 albums, and in doing so, built up a reputation as one of Brazil's top hip-hop MCs. He's also, in the past year, 2 years, emerged as one of the country's most influential cultural figures.
All right, let's check out this track real quick. So do we know if he's a bolsonarista?
I get the feeling from the lyrics he's not a bolsonarista, in that his lyrics come across very, like, you know, very liberatory, like diagnosing the ills of racism, the, you know, the ills of our history with enslavement and police repression, which, like, you know, Bolsonaro loves the police. From what I understand, Bolsonaro hates the blacks and the poor.
Yeah.
So yeah. I'm gonna assume there's like a not. They don't really.
He looks way too cool to fuck with them.
Come and on, he looks man. Way too cool. Like, come I want to be this nigga's friend.
Come
MC,
on.
Can I be your friend? Look at the steez with the little parts in the hair. Sorry. Found this picture of him.
But yeah, they can't see this picture, but yeah.
Homie is
looking
wrong
fresh.
For this.
He is looking fresh to death
fresh
in this
as
picture.
Hell. With the hair
like
tattoos.
Messing
with
his cufflinks and shit.
Ooh, the cufflinks. Lord of mercy. The little wire rim glasses. And the fucking, yeah, beat goes hard. And then you got, you know, you got Emcida. He going in talking about, you know, the police van is a slave ship and the slums of the slave quarters. He's talking about, he's hearkening back to Angola, Congo, Soweto, like his, you know, African homelands, and talking about bin Laden getting made in the USA, and fucking talking about the KKK. And so he's talking about all these different, like, international intersections between, you know, we're at the middle of which comes, like, the Black Brazilian struggle, which has many parallels to the Black American struggle. So fucking beat goes hard. All I'm saying is the beat goes hard. The lyrics go hard. The video's
of note too. It's got like a scene of workers' revolt in like like I got plantation vibes, although I don't know that they explicitly showed it was a plantation house.
I'm sure that parallel was the implication was
there
intentional. Like, oh yeah, okay. They're like
yeah,
like understated, but like definitely, you know, trying to nod a little bit to it, because I mean, yeah, we're still living on a fucking plantation.
Yeah,
today.
The beat goes hard. Instrumentally, I was making this comment before we came back from the jump, but instrumentally, it makes me feel like old school Black Eyed Peas before Fergie, like those sort of beats. All right, enough of admiring homie's wardrobe. Yeah. What do we got next?
What next? Okay. This is not a hip-hop song, and I don't think I've ever deviated from the genre of focus in the history of this show, but goddamn, this is a banger, and Elsa Suarez, who sings this song, is 90 fucking years old, so I thought I had to give a shout-out to the homie, also while bringing attention to the fact that this song, Mujer al Fin del Mundo, which means woman at the end of the world, it's like a fucking feminist anthem in an era where Bolsonaro is out here making jokes about rape and talking about how, you know, women are idiots. Like, I feel like this is a really powerful song worth giving a listen to. Let's give it a spin real quick.
Okay, yeah, no, that shit is dope. I love the instrumental for it, man. That piano pluck.
See, you nailed it. You explained exactly why I felt like this is a good fit. So, because it's got this instrumental feeling, like where it feels like any second the bars are gonna drop.
Yeah, it feels like a beat. You know, like
it feels like a beat. Yeah,
that sounds like somebody made that beat in an MPC. You know,
straight up. I can see West Ruler. Shout out to West, like doing his little thing on the B pad, yeah, with the piano and the shit
with the pluck strings.
Which, if no one has sampled the song, maybe they should, because it's, yeah, you know, to get a little loop going with the fucking instruments in the background and shit.
So why don't you tell the people what the song's about?
So, the song, it's showcases feminist resistance to oppression, in lines like, on the avenue I left there, my black skin and my voice. My home, my loneliness, I threw it from the third floor. So it's sort of like about throwing out all the shit that's like holding you back with reference to, you know, skin color, with to gender, and sort of like rising above it, like laughing even in the face of insurmountable odds. You know, she describes herself as a woman at the end of the world who will sing until the end, who will sing until the end of the world. And so there was a lot of like, violence against women and femicide going on in Brazil at the time that the song was written. And so sort of like, I guess, giving... It's sort of just like an anthem. Sort of just like an anthem for like this backdrop of violence, of oppression, of just general struggle. A struggle against fascism. Like, you know, keeping your head high above that. While not overtly political in its content, it's one of those things where like, it's inherently political in that it is resistance. It embodies resistance. And so I thought it was really dope.
Those are the best type of political songs, in my opinion.
Best type. It's not preachy. It's not like, hey, go out and vote, kids. It's and that fucking corny-ass shit I do in my dumb-ass music.
Hey,
you know it's true. I'm like, it's go not vote. True. Who are you voting for sheriff? Who are you voting for Solicitor General?
It's not true. It's a style. It's a style. It's
yeah,
a
whatever. My choice. Shit be corny as hell, and I love it. And I embrace it. It's great. But no, it's like understated, but just empowering. It's good shit. I don't know. That was worth it. And this bitch old as hell. Good
yeah,
for you. Good for
it.
You, Elsa Suarez.
And it's black, so we fuck with it.
And it's black as hell.
So...
Our next song is Olho de Tigre by Djonga. Olho de Tigre means I have a tiger. And Djonga is a Belo Horizonte born rapper who, interestingly, was among the finalists for Best International Rapper for the BET Hip Hop Awards last year.
Oh, snap.
In this track, Djonga calls out racism against black Brazilians while taking a jab at Bolsonaro, rhyming, whoever has my color is a thief. Whoever has the color of Eric Clapton is a kleptomaniac. I'm sorry. That's hilarious to me. Because didn't Eric Clapton end up being real racist against, like, immigrants or some shit? Am I thinking of the right guy?
There was something with Eric Clapton. He's Eric one of Clapton, them old white dudes, you know, like him and who's the other guy? I don't know, man. What are these guitar-playing white dudes?
Oh, yeah.
The shit of Morrissey, yeah. It's like, you know, every other day is like, yeah, so Morrissey said this. Yo, so Morrissey said that. We can't fuck with Morrissey no more. And I'm sitting over here like, yo, who the fuck is Morrissey, man? All right. All right. I don't fuck with him. Okay, cool.
Yeah, legit, and don't crucify me for this, listeners, but, like, I don't know if I could name an Eric Clapton song off the top of my head, but I remember he's racist.
Tears in Heaven. Tears in Heaven.
Okay. So
Tears in Heaven.
I just couldn't name one. I didn't say Tears in Heaven is dope.
Tears in Heaven. And what was the other one? He did a joint. There was a movie with John Travolta back in the day called Phenomenon, and he did the theme song for it with Babyface. It was him and Babyface. It was called Change the World. It was like, if I could change the world. They sang it a lot better than that, but you know what I'm saying.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, I didn't know I didn't know that was possible. I don't know. Better than that?
Let's check out this damn song.
All right, let's check out this damn song.
Somos o presente. Na chamada professora de Pantera Negra, eu respondo presente.
So yeah, he talks about how at the time of judgment, God is black and Brazilian. Love that. Mm. And then and this is a little jab at Bolsonaro here. He says, and to save the country, a Christian ex-military man who thinks that women getting together is a whorehouse. So he's like, you think this guy, this quote-unquote Christian guy, this quote-unquote military guy who, like, thinks women are sluts, no. This guy is going to save your country? Well, at the time of judgment, God is black and Brazilian, and he's not going to be pleased with this shit.
So is he really popular?
Oh, yeah, he's mad popular. So he also, last year, I believe, took home the MTV Mia Beat Brazil Award, which apparently is a big deal. During his award show performance, on top of the roof of a building, this is also gets back into the politics of his music, which, like, are found throughout his music and music videos. I encourage y'all to take a look at them all. Lots of examples. But at this award show performance, he drove home an anti-racist message featuring background dancers with shirts imprinted with the slogan "Param de nos matar," which means "Stop killing us." Which apparently in Brazil is also a huge slogan for, like, the anti-racist movement.
Yeah,
which I don't know if it's, like, an offshoot of Black Lives Matter or just, like, the very simple statement of "Please stop killing us" just has this resonance
universal,
regardless of what language it's in.
Yeah, like, it could be applied to any population.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, do they take inspiration from what's happening here, or is it just literally?
That is wild. We should probably look at that, because, I mean, is that just two coincidental movements?
Straight up. I mean, so much. What I also, I think, is revealed in the music of Emcida, of Elsa Suarez, of Djonga today, is the parallels between the United States and Brazil outside of, we talked about fascism and, like, they have the Trump of the tropics down there. Yeah. Also, just the development of, like, the slavery. There's, like, 350 years of slavery in Brazil. You know, the way the police are, you know, murdering black people, hyper-capitalism, all this shit. The way that, like, these similar forces have cooked up similar results for both of our colonies.
Yeah.
I guess you could say. It's interesting how you see that in the music as well, with the themes that come up.
Well, shit. We can only hope that all that stuff, like, is defeated or quells down or mitigated to whatever extent it can be, so
yeah,
that it doesn't
Alex
take
in this
root.
Interview, you know, gave me a little bit of hope that maybe all things are not lost. But you never fucking know. I don't know, even the smartest people, and he was a very smart man. You get caught by surprise sometimes, like, oh shit,
well, one thing that we do know, and that we don't get caught off surprise with, is that that's it. We gotta end this shit.
These fucking bars ain't never catch me off guard.
We will be back next week, but before we go, like the homie just said, we need some bars. So Joel, please, my main man, can you bless us with some heat? Yo, blue collar on the beat. Yeah, I'm a scholar with the heat. The rhymes are at a premium, you try to get them cheap. That's why Bolsonaro got the right wingers in the street. So every time I move, you know I gotta be discreet. It still is kinda hit or miss, he'll say it's illegitimate. He don't really like anybody with a clitoris. Brown folk, queer folk, or people who indigenous. You can even throw a little goose stepping in the mix. But this is in a sense me preaching to the choir. I'm just trying to keep it dope and be a creature you admire. Make a sucker rap a halt, got him screeching on the tire. Everything I say is crack minus ether in the fire. It's dope knife and lingua franca. Take a bow. We a couple superheroes with cape and cowl. Listen close and I'll break it down. Keep your damn mouth shut and give us our reparations now. Yeah. I'm dope knife.
I'm lingua franca.
And you're listening to Waiting on Reparations.
For Black Brazilians as well as Black Americans. Have a
Hurry
good
up with all of it.
Hurry it all up.
See you next week.
Peace. Waiting on Reparations is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.